This looks like a very popular talk. I guess Rusty is winning with, maybe he's giving his talk on how white kernel hackers get all the babes or something. Fine. If you all went over there, I don't have to give the talk. No. Guess we're late already, so I should better start. This talk is called, it's about optimizing device drivers for SMP systems. It's basically, it's mainly based on some work I did while I was at CERN, the European Laboratory of Particle Physics in Geneva. Most of the work I did last year after I went to Usenix last summer, and stupid laptop. Okay. I went to Usenix last summer and had some good talks with Don Becker and a couple of other guys, and I had some ideas about how to improve the performance of a gigabit Ethernet drive I wrote. And so we had some talks about that, and I went home and tried it out and actually showed up to, some of it actually showed up to work, quite amazing. So that's what this talk is about. Why do we actually care about doing SMP aware device drivers, and how to do it, or at least some of how to do it. If anything goes wrong, this is the first time I'm using this laptop for a presentation, and it doesn't behave as my good old one somebody else stole. Bastard. I'm trying to first cover the background, why this talk and how, then try and describe the strategy behind the rewrite. Ouch. Everybody's heard of spin locks, I assume, and if you haven't, then this may not be the place. But what you can do with atomic types instead of spin locks, why you want to, then I'm going to cover something about why you want to do memory mapped I/O instead of classical PC style port I/O. If you're not into rude remarks, better leave now. Something about PCI posting, cache effects, interops, and a little bit about what you can do to actually find out what's going wrong when your driver is running. The background was that I wrote a driver for the Altion Gigabit Ethernet card, which came out, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago? But it's been out for a while. It's a fairly nice PCI card. At that time, Don Becker had already written a driver for the Packet Engines card, but you can't buy that card anymore. So I ran into Altion, and they gave me some cards, and I started playing with it and wrote a driver for it. And I wrote the driver in the classical Ethernet style, the way you would normally write device drivers for Ethernet devices, which works. Then most people don't actually understand that in order to get performance out of high-speed networking, you don't just take your standard dock standard FTPD and then start running data over FTP and then get 10 times as much speed. So I got a bunch of complaints about the performance and stuff. And so I figured, oh, well, let's go and see what we can actually do. I didn't get the performance I wanted on proper applications either, but there's a number of issues with gigabit Ethernet and the design of the whole standard, which leaves the programmers and the hardware designers with some interesting issues to deal with. Gigabit Ethernet has this wonderful property that they kept the packet size at 1,500 bytes, which means back when they did original Ethernet, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, or how long it is now, they had 1,500 byte packets at 10 megabit a second. That was a fairly nice packet per second range for filling the media. Then they did 100 megabits a second, and they kept the same rate, so they went up, you know, the packet per second rate for full media went up by a factor of 10. And then, wonderfully enough, they did that once again with Gigabit Ethernet. So now we have 100 times the packet rate for Gigabit Ethernet, and the media speed has gone up. Other things have improved as well, but the interops are still very expensive, and so it's actually a serious issue. Other than that, the Altion card has some interesting issues, like some people call it mitigation, other people call it coalescing, which I wanted to play with. It had support for... it had multiple rings which could support what they call jumbo frames. Then they had one for normal frames, and they had one for mini frames, which is basically packets. You can set the size, but it could be packets the size of, say, 100 bytes or smaller than 100 bytes, which is perfect for things like TCP-X, I had some good ideas, and then there was, I think everybody remembers the interesting stories around Minecraft and the wonderful test of NT versus Linux. And then there was some hack value involved as well. So that's the reason why I started playing with all of this. Why do we want to optimize for SMP in general? Well, first of all, SMP, you need to do this thing called locking in, actually, to make sure that you don't have two processors in parallel accessing your data structures and you know, one writing a null pointer while the other one is trying to thinks it's got a valid pointer out of there. So you need to do locking in order to avoid crashes. What the problem there is that locking is not free. And so if you just sort of start throwing in big locks and protecting your entire code path with a big lock, then you'll get you will get congestion on these locks. And that's one of the things that Linux 2.0, for instance, suffered from, because it had this big global kernel lock which was protecting, you know, as soon as you enter the kernel, you grab the lock. And then afterwards, somebody else tries to enter the kernel, and it'll have to wait for the lock to be released. Then you try and move into more fine-grained locks, but still, you have to be careful, but because even with more fine-grained locks, you still see a lot of contention on high-speed things, especially on things like gigabit Ethernet, because it's got such a high packet per second rate and such a high interrupt rate. I could basically see spin lock contention in my code when I was profiling the code, so I had to do something about that. Then on top of that, you want to avoid funny cache effects by having multiple CPUs access the same data structures in memory. And you can get a nice effect called a cache line ping pong, basically, when you have two CPUs which are concurrently trying to write to the same point or the same cache line in memory. And they'll keep, one will write and stall the other one, then it'll write, and it gives a similar effect. And then I don't know how many of you have looked at old Linux drivers, but a lot of the old Linux drivers which were written for ISA devices and stuff are not very pretty, and they tend to use this wonderful approach saying, oh, I want to protect my data structure. Let's just disable all the interrupts on the system. That's very fine, but it doesn't work well in SMP, because when you want to disable interrupts on the entire system, you have to disable interrupts on your local processor, and then you have to tell all the other processors to shut down their interrupts, and you have to wait for that. So that if you have a 16 CPU system, that's going to take a long time. So that's another thing you want to get around. So this is the new slide. How do you optimize for SMP? Well, basically what you want to do on SMP is you want to use the multiple processors you have and give them the opportunity to run multiple code paths in parallel. So what you want to do is to look at your code, look at your driver and the hardware and say, what parts of this code, what parts of my driver can I split into totally independent code paths which do not actually bother each other? So that's something to try and identify in the code. And for the classical example of a network device, you often have a transmit part and you have a receive part in the device. And if the hardware is designed in a proper way, you can often separate those pretty much. With good hardware, you can have them run completely independently, which is nice. For that, you also want to disentangle the data structures to avoid the cache effects. So you want to try and group in your data structures in order to use the caches right. You want to try and put your data elements for transmit in the same part of memory and the data elements which control the transmit structure in the same part of memory. And you want to try and use CPU cache locality so you don't run a little bit of code here and then tell the other CPU to run a little bit of code for the same thing, et cetera, et cetera. And you want to minimize how you're locking, how the code is actually locking, so you don't keep global locks over stuff which doesn't really need a lock. As an example, I'm gonna try and use Ethernet devices as examples, but a lot of this can actually be applied to most types of device drivers. Some of this stuff you really don't care about. I mean, if you have a 9600 baud mouse device, you don't care. It's just like, you know, don't care about it. You're not going to run with a mouse on a big SMP system anyway. But for anything that's a little bit related to performance, it's worth looking into. But I'll stick to the Ethernet devices, and you can fairly easily, you know, use common sense and apply this to most. A lot of this can be applied to SCSI or whatever as well, SCSI and serial and etc., etc. If you look at a traditional Ethernet device in the good old Linux style, then what happens is that the hardware will normally have a ring buffer for transmit and a ring buffer for receive. And these two rings are fixed size. For transmit, of course, you only what happens there is that you fill in, when you transmit packets, you put them in, and the card will take them out and tell you, and that'll empty the queue, or empty the ring. So you don't have a fixed size number of buffers allocated for that at any point. You have a maximum and a minimum, the minimum normally being zero. However, for receiving, you normally have a fixed number of buffers allocated at any time for receive buffers. And what happens in the driver, I don't have any of these flashy pens, but what normally happens in the traditional Ethernet driver is that you get a packet coming in, you get an interrupt, your code will pull out the data from the buffer, or it'll take the buffer, allocate a new buffer for a new packet, stick that into the data structure, and then you'll queue the packet send it up to the TCP, the old packet coming in, send it up to the TCP stack. And you'll sort of run a loop doing that until you've emptied the ring for this run. And then you'll go out and you'll tell the stack, you know, go process all the packets I've handed up to you. And that'll happen normally in the bottom half or one of these software interrupts. I think it runs in a tasklet now, I think. For the transmit, you basically do allocate a buffer and prepare the packet, queue it, the device, you queue it, you send it to the hardware, and at some point you'll get an interrupt where the hardware tells you, I've sent out the packet, and you'll empty the ring and take out the buffer and free the space you allocate and blah, blah, blah. So the properties of this is that you have this static number of receive buffers. The interrupt handler receive code path is like very cyclic. You keep doing the same thing over and over again. The TX and RX routines can run in parallel, provided that you do not have to access the same registers for both TX and RX. If you have registers which will do both, you have to be careful play with locking and stuff to avoid having the RX routine set some stuff at the same time as the TX routine is trying to read the register, etc. So basically share data structures and registers. In the old ASNIC driver I did, some idiot put in some spin locks which should never have been there. And I measured, actually. These spin locks were just in the... they were used in the transmit routine, and they were used in the interrupt handler, basically protecting the whole block of transmit and the whole block of interrupt. And when I was measuring it, I actually saw a lock contention of 1.5 to 3%. That means 1.5 to 3% of the time when one of these two was trying to take the lock, it was actually seeing... No, hang on. This is actually just for the interrupt handler. So these numbers were actually when the interrupt handler was trying to grab the lock. Half the, 1.5 to 3% of the time, it had to wait for a while until it could get the lock, and that's just quite a lot just for that little bit of code. So I had another idea. Completely disentangle the two code paths. What I wanted to do was to try and also use cache locality, so I would run as much code in as tight a loop as possible in one go, and then sort of block it into small blocks of code, run a loop there, and then finish everything I need to do there, and then go another one and do another loop and finish the next part. So what I do now, the ASNIC has this nice property that you can have really, really deep rings. Instead of having 32 entries for receives, you can have, I think, 512, which gives you a little bit more leaving room for doing things like pipelining. So what I do now is that when I get a packet coming in, I'll take it out and I'll queue it, and then I'll take the next one and queue it, and I'll take the next one and queue it and run all of that, and send those up to the stack. I'll run run the TCP code and tell the TCP stack to process my data. And then afterwards, once I get down to a certain threshold in receive buffers, I'll run... I'll allocate a pile of new receive buffers in one go. So instead of doing one buffer received, allocate a new one, I'll say maybe receive 16 packets and then allocate 16 packets in one go. And at the same time, I would do this in a low priority handler. So this could run when the CPU had spare time, basically a software interrupt. The transmit queue looks very much the same. I'm way too fast for this. What happened was that I would never have this static number of RX handlers, RX buffers. I would do the buffer allocation in bursts, which is good for the cache locality. So the kmalloc code would run, you know, very very in a tighter loop when I was allocating code. I used these watermarks to determine when to do buffer allocation. So I would say I would have up to maybe 128 receive buffers maximum allocated, and I would allow down to maybe 16, saying when I get to 16, when I get to 32, I'll start allocating again. If I get down to 16, I'm in a warning level, a critical low, and I would allocate straight away after having processed my data. I would also move things like the buffer allocation outside the main interrupt handler, except when I was in the critical low mark, to shorten the code path in the interrupt handler itself, which is fairly important, so you don't actually have this sort of live lock, very blockless system for way too long. I changed the RX and TX code to run in a fully independent way, and just by doing these changes, which were not that major changes, it was a fair amount of work doing the code changes, but in the operations, it wasn't that different. I got about a 10% speed up just from these changes, which is not, in my opinion, not too bad. And if you can get 10% here and 10% there, it all sums up. So how did I get rid of all the spin locks? Because I had these counters, which were taking care of you know, telling me how many buffers I had. Linux has this nice thing about, well, basically you get this race condition between the receiving code and the interrupt handler, which will be taking out packets and say, oh, now you only have 5 packets left, and you have the refilling code, which will say, oh, I added another 17 buffers. So what I use is I used atomic tights. They are still fairly expensive, like spinlock, but it's normally a single operation. With this atomic type, which I used as a counter. So the only thing I have which will give a little bit of contention, which will be one bus operation, is the atomic type. So after I've been pulling out my 15 new packets coming in, I'll just do an atomic subtract and subtract 15 from the number of received buffers in my queue. And that way I reduce the number of these atomic operations significantly. I don't do one per packet. I do just one at the end of my cleanup. And the same when I fill new buffers into the receive queues, I sort of say, okay, I added 16, so do an atomic add of 16. The only thing here is you have to take careful when you clean up at the end that your interrupt code is not running at the same time as you're cleaning up and stuff like that, but you always have that, so... bad programmers like me tend to make that one mistake a couple of times, and people will notice it. I had a problem with DHCP, which will close the device, would do this. So the result is you get 0% lock contention, but that's not quite true. You still get a little bit because you get these atomic bus operations, which are where one CPU will need to make sure that all the other CPUs will read the same data at the next time. The bad news is that some of the hardware out there is crap, just put it nicely. Some of the people who used to design ISA hardware, I don't know if any of you ever written code for ISA devices, but you generally just get a few registers on the bus, and then what you do is you have these indirect registers. So you have one register, which is the address register, and the other one is the data register. And if you have some PCI hardware manufacturers thought, wow, we'll just take our ISA device. What's going on? Some PCI people will just, you know, take the ISA device and then put it over into a PCI chip and say, wow, let's do this again, which is inherently stupid. But if you have this, you need to use locks to prevent the case that one CPU will set the address register, then the other CPU will set the address register, and the first one will then try to access the data, but he's not getting the data he expects. So in this case, you really need to use locks to protect all the register access. And that's just nothing you can do about it. If you have hardware like that, it's just like, well, don't use this for high-performance SMP work.
Presumably, there are also some network cards that share a register for receiving and transmitting operations.
I don't know of any that do that. I haven't looked too carefully. I know that some of the 3COM cards will have these indirect registers. I think including the 59X series, the 905s. I don't think the EE Pro and the Tulips do it, and I don't know so much about the other cards. I've mainly done work on gigabit devices such as gigabit Ethernet and HIPPI. So another thing we found after playing a bit with this was that you have these two methods of doing I/O: the ISA style port I/O, and you have the memory mapped, basically PCI shared memory style I/O. Most drivers are actually using PCI access style I/O for no reason. Almost everything PCI should be able to do memory mapped I/O with the registers. But most driver authors come from the classical PC thing, you know, the classical PC world, and they'll just use the I/O operations because it's easier. It's also awful. Don Becker, Ingo Molnar, myself, and a few others were talking about this at some point. And so Don changed, I think it was the EE Pro driver, and played a bit with it. And he found that by using readL instead of the... readL is the macro to access PCI shared memory. And inL is the equivalent to get a word from the ISA bus, or PCI I/O port. And the readL was about 30% faster than the bus I/O bus version. And the write instruction was about 10 times as fast. It was fairly significant numbers. So just this shows that the I/O port bus is actually extremely slow, and it'll do these very slow blocking operations on the I/O bus, which you don't want to have. They basically just stall the bus, whereas the MMIO also has the advantage that if you know what you're doing, you can actually exploit PCI write posting when appropriate. I'll get back to this one a little bit in the next slide, I think. Basically, when operations are going on PCI, you never read a word at a time. The memory controller will read a full cache line, which is normally 16 or 32 or 64 bytes, read that in, and then give you what you asked for, and read that into the CPU cache. And the same when it writes stuff, it'll write out a whole line at a time. So what you can do is, if your data structures are nice, like, say, if you have buffer descriptors for Ethernet, you often have the buffer descriptor for an Ethernet packet on a network device is often like you have a pointer to the packet, you have a size, and you may have some sort of type. So you often have like 2, 3, 4 words of data you want to write out for one buffer descriptor. But the buffer descriptor is not ready before you've written all these 3 or 4 values out anyway. So what you can do is you can use this PCI write posting and use these other versions of the access macros, which will store all these 4 values into the... If it's within the same cache line, you store all these values without actually writing it over, putting it over the PCI bus. Then once you're done, you'll use the write memory barrier, which will then force the data to go over the bus. And that way you reduce the number of PCI operations you see on the bus. It's something to be fairly careful with, and you should be aware of what you're doing when you play with it. But you can gain a little bit extra on this. Buffer descriptors are, as I say, the obvious example. There are other places where you can use it as well. The interface to use this was something we introduced back in 2.3 something, sometime in the spring. We had a big fight over it because it turned out that when the readL writeL macros were designed, they were designed by the guys on the alpha. And the alpha guys were sort of like, well, let's have them as simple as possible. That's the obvious thing to do. So they would basically provide non-ordered memory access to the memory. Whereas then at some point the PowerPC guys said, no, in order for this to actually work in a good way, let's make it ordered memory. So basically, with unordered memory, you can have like 2 reads, and you cannot guarantee which one happens first. The processor may schedule the instructions in a different way. But the PowerPC guys were saying, well, in order to make all make this work the best way possible, let's make our PCI stuff behave as on the PC, as it was at that time. So they said, oh, the obvious must be, you know, to have it in an ordered way. And the Spark guys did the same. But that the result was we had, you know, two different views of oh, this is the obvious way that this works. It's not a good thing. So now we have this raw read-write, byte-write, byte-word-long access to PCI memory. Another reason what happens there is if you use these macros, you'll get the host CPU native read data in. So basically, if you have a big-endian machine, you will not get... PCI buses are a little engine, but if you have a big-endian machine, you will get data read as big-endian. It will not be byte-swapped for you as you would normally expect when reading from the PCI bus. So that's one thing to take into account. But they have the advantage that you can play with things like write posting. And it's, for instance, it's great for graphics. There are some machines have to use frame buffers, and frame buffer memory is normally on the PCI bus. And if you have ordered instruction and you have to update a bit, you know, a 10x24x768x32-bit map when you're scrolling your screen, it's going to take a long time if you have to, you know, have ordered instructions. It slows it down significantly. So for those people, it made a difference as well. So in order to guarantee your ordering, you will use the MB, RMB, and WMB, which is global memory barrier, read memory barrier, and write memory barrier, to ensure the ordering is right. Back? Yeah. They were introduced sometime in 2.3, so if you want to write code which is compatible between 2.3 and 2.2, you have a problem there. You need to provide your own defines which will be dummies on 2.2 and just use the old ones. And as I said, people don't have the same view of how the world works, so that's something to take into account. The other more funny one is the cache effects. Caches are normally accessed as a full line at a time. If you're not familiar with caches, a good book to read in this is the Schimmel book, Operating Systems for Modern Architectures, or is it Unix for Modern Architectures, something like that. It explains it fairly well. I'm sure there are other books on the topic. Basically, what happens is that when you, as I said before, when you want to read something from the bus, it'll always read a cache line at a time. And it's typically 16 or 32 bytes, though it may be different sizes between the L1 and L2 caches. So that's something one has to take into account. Then if you have two CPUs that are concurrently trying to access the same data or access data which is close to each other, which is actually the classical problem, is if you say you have a struct, and the first two elements in the struct are for the read, and the second two elements are for the write, then they'll often be in the same cache line, provided, say your pointer's a 32-bit and you have a 32-byte cache line, you'll have them within the same cache line. So whenever CPU A is trying to access the read pointers, and CPU B is trying to access the write pointers, they'll actually hit the same cache line, even though you don't think you're accessing the same part of memory. So what you want to do there is actually, when you allocate your structures, you actually want to split it out further and waste a bit more memory to make sure that your individual elements are going on different cache lines. And fortunately, we have macros in the compiler which will allow you to use things like the aligned macro I have down at the bottom, the attribute aligned, which you can use to tell the compiler and say, make sure that the next element, even though it may have two integers, then make sure that the next one gets further down. And it's 16 or 32 or 64 byte aligned. As I mentioned before, L1 and L2 caches can be different. Most of the machines on the market right now, the Pentiums, the Alpha, the Spark 64, etc., have a 32 byte cache line, L1 cache line. But some of them have 64 byte L2 cache lines. So it's not enough to actually just align this on L1 caches. You have to make sure it's the L2, which in Linux is the size is in Linux described by the SMP cache bytes define. So you should always use that one and not just say, oh, 32 is safe. That's fairly important. One of the places where I saw this was when I was playing with Gigabit Ethernet in the beginning. We have this slap memory allocator, which is a caching. It's a memory allocator which will cache objects of a specific size. So you can, if you know for sure that, I'm going to use I'm going to use hundreds and hundreds of 1500 byte objects often. You say, okay, I'll create a slap cache with these objects, so when I want to allocate something, the allocator will go in and look in the cache and say, oh, I got spare objects already of this specific size. And it'll take them out, and it'll put them back in there when you free them. There's more to this, but if you want all the details on Slap, there's a good... the Bonwick paper should be available from Usenet somewhere.
Do you have references to those books on your slides?
No, sorry. But if you send me an email or something, I can probably give you... I can find the titles. But what I saw with the old Slap memory allocator we have is that it would have one global pointer which is pointing into the caches. So it was just having one cache, one bit cache for the entire system, for the different objects. So there would be one pointer. And I saw this ping-pong effect all the time in the allocator. So what some of the commercial operating systems have done, and what Ingo Molnar hacked up a patch for doing, was that we would have caches which were CPU local. So you would have a cache of these objects, a smaller cache, but you would still have a cache of objects per CPU. So when CPU A goes in, it'll look in its own cache first, and you guarantee that nobody else will try to write to that pointer, so you don't see this ping-pong effect when it's updating its pointers. And that gave me, I think, close to a 10% speed-up. On gigabit Ethernet, it was really significant for just such a small change. Ingo's patch back then was fairly rough. It was basically saying everything goes in CPU per CPU slap caches and stuff like that. And it's not always you need that. So I think I don't remember who it was, Manfred Sproul or somebody, who did a new implementation of this, which was more intelligent. We always talked about it, making it more intelligent, but you want to have a more dynamic allocation and saying, I actually use a lot of these objects, so we cache them heavily on the CPU caches, and these are rarely used, so you don't want to do that all the time. But he did a more intelligent, more dynamic version of the allocator, and I think that one's it's in 2.4 now. Thing is, I just moved to Canada like 2 months ago, so all my hardware and stuff has been packed away I haven't touched it for about 3 months, so I haven't actually seen what's happened recently. So it may be actually be in the current code, but it makes a big difference, and not just for networking, so that's pretty good. Another issue to deal with. Any questions to any of this? Okay. In order to see these effects, what I use is the kernel has this profile system where it'll profile on a 4-byte granularity of the code in the kernel. So what I do is I set the profile shift at boot time, so the kernel will keep sampling. And what you'll see then is if you have a function, it'll show you there's a tool called read profile. I think it's part of the modutils or something. And what it'll tell you there is it'll give you a list of the highest sample points it has in the kernel of instructions. And if you have a cache line ping pong effect, you'll often find that one particular instruction if you have a function and it's sort of evenly spread out, you have a good chance that there's no problems in it. But if you have one function which only shows up in one specific instruction in one four byte block, it's often because I found in the slap code there was a store to memory, and that was the one which was hitting all the time, because even though that instruction when it's running to cache, if it's running in local cache, it'll run in one cycle, but if it has to go over the memory bus and propagate to all the other CPUs, or another CPU is trying to fetch it from the first CPU, it'll show up a lot more. So that's one way to see if you have one function and there's specific bits in that function that shows up all the time. It's a rough tool, but it's not hard to use. So, intro.
I was going to say, what about locking the network card to a CPU so that only one CPU handles interrupts from?
Pardon?
Locking the interrupts from a particular
That's the famous Microsoft trick. We talked about doing that and playing with that, and I think the general consensus was that we don't like to do it because it's like, it looks great in benchmarks, but it sucks for real life, and we don't want to do that. Ingo had some ideas about, I don't know how far he got with it, but he had some ideas about using statistics in the APIC to see how often interrupts were called on one CPU, and then try and dynamically allocate the interrupts. So if you had four interfaces, you could sort of try and, at runtime, dynamically allocate and say, I'll try and run this interrupt handler on the CPU all the time, or most of the time. But I think he never got around to implementing it. But I think we, in general, we don't like doing static allocation. We don't want to do that if we can avoid it, because we don't want to tune the kernel for benchmarks. I mean, it's something you have to be careful with. Ingo had some ideas about using the APIC for it, using some of the statistics he could pull out of the IO APIC on the PC and use that for it. But I think he never got around to implementing it. I have to sort of poke him again and see if he's up for it now. That's the problem we have. You know, we have people like Ingo who's doing this tux test and things like that, and you know, he gets a great idea, but he doesn't have time to implement it. Okay. Another thing I found was that interrupts show up a lot. I've been told it's better now with the current code, with the more recent interrupt implementation. But what I found when I was doing my code was that the code calling into my interrupt handler, just the kernel's generic interrupt handling code, showed up a lot. It was really expensive, and basically you need to reduce the number of interrupts if you have a high performance device. Gigabit Ethernet is particularly nasty because if you want to fill a gigabit Ethernet with just say maximum, I don't know how many of you heard Jamal's talk, but if you want to fill a gigabit Ethernet with 1500 byte packets, theoretically you're still talking 80,000 packets a second, which is quite a lot. If you get an interrupt per packet, plus you can do the math on how long time it takes to actually process an interrupt just to switch context and store the data on the stack, that's quite a lot of time. So you want to reduce the number of interrupts in order to actually get performance. With the ASNIC, I have been able to... It has some of these propagation coalescing parameters or mitigation parameters. And with that, I could do like 65 megabytes a second data over the wire at about 2,000 interrupts a second, 2,500. Latency gets bad because you can get a packet in. It'll take quite a while before you get the interrupt generated. But if you're actually able to pipeline your flow of data, that means if you have big, large TCP streams, it makes a lot of sense. So it's something you want to find a good balance there where you actually get your latency right and you still don't get flooded in overhead of interrupts.
What platform
is
that?
X86. Dual P2 450, I think. I think it was the 440BX chipset. So it's a fairly common machine. 128, I think it was just 128 megs of memory. So you want to reduce the number of interrupts. You want to do as much as possible in the interrupt handler once it's invoked. But there's again a catch, sort of, because you also want to make sure that you don't make your interrupt handler run for so long that you're blocking other stuff and get live lock in it. So there's a magic balance you have to find there. Generally, what I find is that if you have a thing like a ring-structured device, it's a bad idea to keep reading the incoming pointer once you're in the interrupt handler. Read it when you go in and then process everything there is in there once you go in and then go out again and let another interrupt happen if there's more stuff coming in. Don't keep reading it, because if you have a network which is flooding you, you'll stay in the interrupt handler forever, basically. And that's not very healthy. And then if you have time-consuming work, like some of the networking code, some of the SCSI code, block handling, put it in the bottom half handlers. As you can see, some of these slides are not from yesterday. Now that would be a tasklet, one of Alexei's inventions. And so that, because the bottom half and the task list have the advantage that you can allow processing of higher priority interrupts while you're running your code. You just have to make sure that your code can handle the stuff you run in the bottom half handler. You have to make sure that code can actually live with the fact that the interrupt handler itself comes back while this is running. The bottom half and the task list run with all interrupts enabled, even for your own device. Oops, that was the wrong way. So this is actually the last one. The best tools I've found for analyzing these things has been the profiling using Read Profile, as I mentioned. It shows high hit rate on specific small blocks of code. Another thing is the log meter from SGI, which I find is a really cute little tool. It's basically a package which will implement profiling on all the spin locks, and it'll give you statistics about what spin locks are, or on which spin locks you have a lot of congestion, how often you take a spin lock, how often somebody takes it and it's congested and stuff like that. It gives you lots of statistics. It's quite a useful tool. Of course, when using tools like this, you have to be aware that they do affect the data flow. They do affect your data flow a bit. So always keep that in mind. You can't actually monitor something without affecting it. But these tools are pretty neat, and that's the ones I use when I'm playing with stuff. So you can find them there. That's about all I had, and we have, I think, more than plenty of time for questions now.
The postable I/O accesses, non-postable I/O is supposed to be non-postable I/O port space accesses versus MIO accesses. Now, is that a semantic of the Intel, or who drives that?
I think it's the semantic of PCI in general. Basically. I'm not sure. I haven't read the specs recently, but at least on some PCI controllers you can do it, and I think there's some where you can't. So it's up to the PCI controller you have. It's basically a feature which you can utilize if you know how to use it and you feel comfortable with what you're doing and you think there's a win. You can play with it and see if it gives you anything. If you're unfortunate and you have a pile of junk, then you don't care.
On the theorist board, I'm enforcing the semantic. Mm.
Mm.
And I was just wondering if there's some way to get who requires that. I was just wondering if Intel.
I don't know if it's specific to Intel chips. It's an option which you should be able to play with, and you should be able to see it in Intel chips, as far as I know.
Okay.
I don't have hard data on it right now.
Expected behavior by the driver.
It's the driver should say, "Oh, I can do this." But if you don't want to think about it, you just use the ordinary instructions which are ordered. It was about the unordered access to PCI shared memory, whether or not it's in the Intel controllers or it's a standard thing in the spec. Do you know that?
Do you mean whether reads can occur out of order with writes?
No, more whether...
Thank you.
Yeah, I probably have the impression it's something people are sort of saying, we want I/O ports to behave like ISA because we don't have to bother about changing drivers and worrying about them. So. You do write, read, utilize, write, read.
Okay.
Anybody else? Okay, everybody's sleeping, I guess.
Well, sure. Block meter and read profile, are those only on x86 or are there other architectures that support them?
Read profile should work on any architecture.
Okay.
Lock meter requires modification to the spin lock implementation. And I'm not aware whether they've ported it to other architectures. You'll have to check their web page. It's possible somebody ported it. Yeah. So. Yes? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. For timing? Okay. I know Trich did some play with the CPU timer, the TSC or whatever it's called on the x86 or something. Yeah, Trich did some of that work when we were back when we had all the Minecraft mess. Of course, people were working pretty hard on finding out what went wrong, and so there was a lot of tests going on with related to SMB. We did a lot of SMB benchmarks. There was a guy at SGI who happened to have access to, you know, a nice big farm of Windows machines and one box as a server, and we could sort of use that to hit the machine hard and stuff like that. And I know Trich was playing with those things, but I don't think any of that is in the generic kernel now. Yeah. So I don't know where it is. Sorry. Well, it's basically a static value, so you don't have to worry about it being a dynamic thing that's being... You can use it in a structured declaration, basically.
Is it only set when SMB is configured?
No. Not as far as I know. You need to include asm/cache.h, and it should be in there. Anyone else? Okay. Gone.